Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. We are very pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. For a list of our upcoming events, please pick up a copy of the January newsletter at the front desk. As we begin, may I remind you please to silence all electronic devices. I said this Monday night we had a performance going on. We had a cell phone bring in the middle of it. It was very musical, but it didn't really add a whole lot. So please, tonight, let's not have that happen, if you will. I'd also like to remind you that the Society Library and programs like this prosper because of the generosity of our donors. For more information, please speak to me or to our development staff or see our website. We have books for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery directly outside this room, and you can get them autographed following the event. It's now my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Richard Panik. Richard is an old hand at the library, having been a member for over 15 years, and having lectured for us on his last book, The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes. The hidden universes aspect is clearly continuing into the book under consideration tonight, the 4% universe. The 4% is everything we know about. As someone put it, it's you, me, rocks, Oprah. The hidden part is what people are still trying to find, locate, define, or figure out, leaving a compelling narrative of frustration and discovery. I might also mention that for the library's 250th anniversary in 2004, Richard wrote one of my favorite testimonials, describing the cacophony of opinions to be found on any shelf of the library's nonfiction collection. The stacks, you might say, are a whole hidden universe of their own. And yet still, they're only a fraction of the books that exist, of the ideas that exist, in all the human brains that exist, and all of that is included in only 4% of reality. It kind of blows my mind. I'm glad to have such a competent guide to it, Richard Panik.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you to the library, too, for inviting me back, and thank you to all of you for coming out here. I was signing books at the Air and Space Museum a couple of weekends ago. They were my own books, I should say. I tried signing. But I was sitting at the table, and there's this all the time, so she's used to this, and she doesn't really care who's there. But she picked up the book during a lull, and she started looking at the inside flap. After a few moments, she went, "That's crazy!" And I thought that was a pretty appropriate response. I thought that was just about right. It's actually the response that I had like 10 years ago when I started researching the subject, when I started hearing about it at conferences that I would go to as part of research for other things. And I would think, no, this can't be true, what they're saying, that most of the universe is unknown after all this time, that there must be there must be some hyperbole involved. They must be, looking for a grant or something. So they're sexing it up. But the more I looked into it, the more I saw that it was that the people who were involved in it, who were making these discoveries, were trying to knock them down in good scientific fashion. They were trying to show that they were wrong, and their colleagues were trying to show that they were wrong. And the harder they tried, the more they found that, in fact, there is a lot of validity to this. And so it has now become part of the standard cosmological picture. As Sarah said, what we've always thought of as the universe is only 4% of what's out there. 23% is dark matter, 73% is dark energy. We don't know what either of those are. In this book, I try to argue that this is a fundamental transformation in the way that we think about the universe. I'm not alone in this. The scientists think so too, but the word hasn't quite spread. The New York Times and the Science Times has written about this a lot, so you've probably heard about the topic. You've probably heard about dark matter, dark energy. I was giving a talk at Microsoft last week, and in that room I said, has anybody here heard of dark matter, dark energy? Like, every hand in the room went up, so but that's Microsoft. But I don't expect, even in that room, even in that environment, or in this environment, or any science-literate environment, I don't expect people to really understand that there is this fundamental transformation going on now. So in a way, I think that this book is a form of proselytizing on my part. I want people to know. I want the word to get out there. I want people to understand that there is something really important happening. We don't know where it's going to go. We don't know what's going to happen to physics or philosophy, but something big is going to happen. So I know that at these lectures that they're not readings, but I'm going to read a little bit. I'm going to do three little readings, and I'll talk between those. But just to give you a sense, as I said, these will be brief. This whole talk probably goes about 35 minutes, something like that. I always like to know that in advance. So. So I'm going to read the prologue first, which is only 3 pages long, and that will set up the book. So I've just given you kind of the setup, and Sarah has given you the setup, but this is what the average reader would know just coming to the book cold, or perhaps having read the inside flap. The time had come to look inside the box. On November 5th, 2009, scientists at 16 institutions around the world took their seats before their computer screens and waited for the show to begin. Two software programs being run simultaneously by two graduate students, one at the University of Minnesota, the other at the California Institute of Technology. For 15 minutes, the two scripts would sort through data that had been collecting far underground in a long abandoned mine in northern Minnesota. Over the past year, 30 ultrasensitive detectors, deep freeze cavities the size of refrigerators, shielded from stray cosmic rays by half a mile of bedrock, their interiors cooled almost to absolute zero, each interior harboring a heart of germanium atoms, had been looking for a particular piece of the universe. The data from that search had sped from the detectors to off-site computers, where, following the protocol of a blind analysis, it remained in a box, out of sight. Just after 9 a.m. Central Time, the unblinding party began. Jody Cooley watched on the screen in her office at Southern Methodist University. As the coordinator of data analysis for the experiment, she had made sure that researchers wrote the two scripts separately using two independent approaches so as to further ensure against bias. She had also arranged for all the collaborators on the project, physicists at Stanford, Berkeley, Brown, in Florida, Texas, Ohio, Switzerland, to be sitting at their computers at the same time. Together, they would watch the evidence as it popped up on their screens, one plot per detector, two versions of each plot. After a few moments, plots began appearing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Then, 3 or 4 minutes into the run, a detection appeared on the same plots in both programs. A dot on a graph, a dot within a narrow desirable band, a band where all the other dots weren't falling. A few minutes later, another pair of dots on another pair of plots appeared within the same narrow band. And a few minutes later, the programs had run their course. That was it then, two detections. Wow, Cooley thought. Wow, as in they had actually seen something when they had expected to get the same result as the previous peak inside a box of different data nearly 2 years earlier. Nothing. Wow, as in, if you're going to get detections, two is a frustrating number, statistically tantalizing but not sufficient to claim a discovery. But mostly, wow, as in, they might have gotten the first glimpse of dark matter, a piece of our universe that until recently we hadn't even known to look for, because until recently we hadn't realized that our universe was almost entirely missing. It wouldn't be the first time that the vast majority of the universe turned out to be hidden to us. In 1610, Galileo announced to the world that by observing the heavens through a new instrument, what we would call a telescope, he had discovered that the universe consists of more than meets the eye. The 500 copies of the pamphlet announcing his results sold out immediately. When a package containing a copy arrived in Florence, a crowd quickly gathered around the recipient and demanded to hear every word. For as long as members of our species had been lying on our backs, looking up at the night sky, we had assumed that what we saw was all there was. But then Galileo found mountains on the moon, satellites of Jupiter, hundreds of stars. Suddenly we had a new universe to explore, one to which astronomers would add over the next 4 centuries, new moons around other planets, new planets around our sun, hundreds of planets around other stars, 100 billion stars in our galaxy, hundreds of billions of galaxies beyond our own. By the first decade of the 21st century, however, astronomers had concluded that even this extravagant census of the universe might be as out of date as the 5-planet cosmos that Galileo inherited from the ancients. The new universe consists of only a minuscule fraction of what we had always assumed it did. the material that makes up you and me and my laptop and Oprah, I guess, too, and all those moons and planets and stars and galaxies. The rest, the overwhelming majority of the universe, is, who knows, dark, cosmologists call it, in what could go down in history as the ultimate semantic surrender. This is not dark as in distant or invisible. This is not dark as in black holes or deep space. This is dark as in unknown for now and possibly forever. 23% something mysterious that they call dark matter. 73% something even more mysterious that they call dark energy. Which leaves only 4% the stuff of us. As one theorist likes to say at public lectures, we're just a bit of pollution. Get rid of us and everything else we've ever thought of as the universe, and very little would change. We're completely irrelevant, he adds cheerfully. All well and good. Astronomy is full of Homo sapiens' humbling insights, but these lessons in insignificance had always been at least somewhat ameliorated by a deeper understanding of the universe. The more we could observe, the more we would know. But what about the less we could observe? What happens to our understanding of the universe then? What currently unimaginable repercussions would this limitation and our ability to overcome it or not have for our laws of physics and our philosophy, our twin frames of reference for our relationship to the universe? Astronomers are finding out. The ultimate Copernican revolution, as they often call it, is taking place right now. It's happening in underground mines where ultra-sensitive detectors wait for the ping of a hypothetical particle that might already have arrived or might never come. And it's happening in ivory towers where coffee break conversations conjure multiverses out of espresso steam. It's happening at the South Pole, where telescopes monitor the relic radiation from the Big Bang. In Stockholm, where Nobelists have already begun to receive recognition for their encounters with the dark side. On the laptops of postdocs around the world as they observe the real-time self-annihilations of stars billions of light years distant from the comfort of a living room couch. It's happening in healthy collaborations and, the universe being the intrinsically Darwinian place it is, in career-threatening competitions. The astronomers who have found themselves leading this revolution didn't set out to do so. Like Galileo, they had no reason to expect that they would discover new phenomena. They weren't looking for dark matter. They weren't looking for dark energy. And when they found the evidence for dark matter and dark energy, they didn't believe it. But as more and better evidence accumulated, they and their peers reached a consensus that the universe we thought we knew, for as long as civilization had been looking at the night sky, is only a shadow of what's out there. That we have been blind to the actual universe because it consists of less than meets the eye, and that that universe is our universe, one we are only beginning to explore. It's 1610 all over again. So that's the framework for the argument, that we were at that point in history again where the universe turns out to be mostly not what we thought it was. In the same way that Copernicus found a model for a universe that had the sun at the center, and then Galileo came along and validated that through his observations. In the same way, we're going through that same kind of fundamental new understanding of the universe. So how did astronomers come to this? The universe, as we think of it now, with all these galaxies that I mentioned, really dates only to 1924, when Edwin Hubble discovered that some of these swirls in the sky, the most, you know, the farthest reaches that telescopes could get to at that time, were actually separate, what they called in those days, island universes, what we would now call galaxies, this collection of stars and gas that we call the Milky Way. So these galaxies suddenly meant that the universe was much bigger than it had been. And this was not inconsistent with the way that the universe had been built up over the preceding several hundred years, that you find more planets and so on, you find more stars, you find more galaxies. But I don't know, I was like thinking that it really is that recent, that it's 1924. My father, who's still alive, was born in 1920, and I often think that my father is older than the universe, which I don't tell him, but it's... But I think it. And then in 1929, Hubble discovered that there was this relationship between galaxies between their distances and how fast they appear to be receding from us, and that there's this kind of one-to-one relationship, the farther, the faster. And from that, people inferred the Big Bang. So in the 1950s, there was an astronomer, early 1950s, there was an astronomer named Vera Rubin. Have people heard of her? You know who she is? Okay. And she's still around, too. In fact, I had dinner with her a couple of weeks ago. She came of age at a time when this idea of galaxies was still new. The people who were older than her, like the other generation of astronomers, hadn't yet adapted to that. So she saw galaxies, and she just like naturally thought, well, what can we do with them? How do they perform? And she began doing some investigations into that in the 50s. Then she took off some time to raise a family. And in the 60s, she went back to her first love, which was galaxies. And she had the benefit, by the late 60s, of working with an instrument that would allow astronomers to look at precise points in galaxies at a far more rapid rate than they could have before. She was collaborating with an instrumentalist named W. Kent Ford, and he had developed this particular type of spectrograph, image tube spectrograph. So they started making these observations, and her goal was to look at the Andromeda galaxy, which is the nearest one to our own that resembles ours, and to look at it farther along. You know, it's a spiral galaxy, and you go off along the edges, and you get, you know, stars, and the gas get thinner and thinner out there. And she wanted to go as far as she could out there using this instrument. And she and her collaborator succeeded. But what they found, and this puzzled her at the time, but she's an observer, and she doesn't deal with theory. That is, she doesn't try to come up with the ideas. She just thought, well, that's weird. She found that the outside, the farthest parts of the galaxies, are spinning as rapidly as the inner parts of the galaxies, which violates Newton's laws, Kepler's laws. I mean, it's as if, you know, Pluto were keeping pace with Mercury around the sun. I mean, you know, we would be going, if we were doing that, we would be going around the sun like every 80 days or something like that, if we were moving as fast as Mercury. But we're not, because there is this inverse square relationship between the mass of the sun and the distance from it. And so, you know, as you go farther out, it drops off. But if you look, she found that if you look at the Andromeda galaxy, you can see, if you just take what's there, the stars and the gas, they are violating in this way as if Pluto were going around the sun at the same rate as Mercury. Now, she didn't do anything with that except to report it. And prior to that, because other people didn't have the proper instrumentation or the latest instrumentation, people would normally, if they were graphing it, they would say, you know, here's the distance from the center of the galaxy, and here's how rapidly the stars are spinning. And at a certain point, they would just draw a dotted line because they assumed that it would have to be slowing down. The dotted line going down would represent the outer parts of the galaxy slowing down. And she said, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to put in data that's not there. What I'm getting is a straight line. It's not falling off. The rates aren't falling off. At the same time, some radio astronomers then began to get the same kind of reading on other galaxies. And at the same time, there were an astronomer and a theorist at Princeton who were modeling what the Milky Way galaxy is, our own galaxy, not the Andromeda, but the Milky Way, how it should be behaving based on what we see of it, the stars and the gas. And they were finding that it should be unstable, that it's moving too fast, that it should be spinning apart. The Milky Way has gone through probably 12, 15 rotations, something like that, in its history. And from their computer simulations, it should have been falling apart before it even reached the end of its first rotation. It should just be wobbling and spreading. So they said, okay, what if we put something else there that would stabilize it gravitationally? We'll just make it up, and we'll just put something in there. We'll make a halo and put it in the galaxy. And they made it smaller than the galaxy, and that didn't work. So they made a bigger halo, bigger than the galaxy. That didn't work. And they made another halo. That didn't work. And they kept making bigger halos until finally they had a model that was something like this was the halo, and the little galaxy was in there. And they thought, then the motions made sense. Then this thing turning so quickly in its entirety, this galaxy in there, then it made sense because this part out here would be moving slowly. Okay, so there's this convergence of evidence, the theory from the Princeton computer models, the observations from Vera Rubin in the optical, the radio observations begin getting the same thing. And throughout the 70s, again and again and again, she makes more observations, Vera Rubin. Other astronomers make more observations. And again, every observation, there's this straight line, this flat rotation curve, they call it. It's not falling off. By the end of the 70s, and of course, there's great resistance to this idea that there might be something else out there, but by the end of the 70s, the community has just, the astronomy community has just been overwhelmed by the evidence. I mean, it's just there. It's just there on the page in paper after paper, and they finally kind of, there's like a transition in 78, 79, where astronomers just kind of say, we have to look at this. We have to take this seriously and look at it more seriously. There are other reasons why they took it seriously, and those are in the book, but I don't need to go into them here. But now, okay, so now you have an expanding universe, and you have matter in it, and you have dark matter, right? You have regular matter and dark matter. So you have all this matter in the universe, and you have this universe that's expanding, and because matter interacts with other matter gravitationally, the universe that's expanding like this is, you know, going to be slowing down because of gravity. Now, the question that scientists started to ask in the 1980s, I mean, they'd asked it earlier, but they could really begin to look for the answer, was how much is this expansion slowing down? Is it slowing down? Is there so much matter in the universe that eventually it'll kind of stop and contract again in kind of a reverse Big Bang? Or is there just not enough and it'll just kind of peter out forever? And, you know, if it collapses back on itself, they call that the Big Crunch, and if it keeps going, they call that the Big Chill. So two teams of astronomers in the 1990s set out to find out which scenario was right. They were going out to find out the fate of the universe. It was a sort of hubristic exercise, but you know that's what astronomy is so often in cosmology. And I don't say that demeaningly. I mean, it's just, you know, it's part of the fun, I think. So they need, in order to see how much the expansion of the universe is slowing down, they need something that they can see at far distances across the universe because they need to be able to trace it out. Remember I said earlier the galaxies are receding the faster, the farther, and they're making this kind of, you know, if you graph it, it's a straight line. But that straight line means that the universe is as far out as you look, the farther the galaxy, the faster, which means that there's no gravitational action, which means that there's no matter in the universe. So at some point, that line is going to have to curve a little bit. It's going to have to curve to represent that the universe is slowing down under the influence of gravity and matter. If it doesn't, if there is no gravity and matter, then it goes on a straight line. But there is gravity and matter, so they're looking to see how the curve is going to drop a little bit. And as I said, they need something that they can see at great distances, something that they call a standard candle. And they come up with a candidate called supernovae exploding stars, type 1A supernovae. And they have reason to believe that even if they're not standard candles, they can make them standard candles by calibrating things. So if you know how bright it should be, I mean, if you know that there's a 100-watt bulb and it's 10 feet away, and you know that it's a 100-watt bulb and you can see that it's 10 feet away, and then if you see another bulb of a certain brightness that you know is 100 watts, and you see it's at a certain brightness, you can figure out how distant it is just by, you know, simple mathematical formula. You go, well, it's a 100-watt bulb. It looks to me like a 35-watt bulb. Therefore, it's whatever distance it is. And they were doing the same thing with supernovae. And at some point, they were expecting that the expectation of, you know, the 35-watt bulb is going to be, you know, 40 feet from here. They're going to say, oh, well, actually, it's going to turn out to be, it should correspond to like 39 feet from here because the expansion is slowing down. So people following that? Is that pretty clear? Okay, great. Thank you. So throughout the 90s, these two teams are racing each other. One is a team of physicists primarily, and one is a team of astronomers. The physicists start looking first. What the astronomers think is crazy because the astronomers know how difficult it is to look for supernovae, and there are all sorts of problems with it. The physicists, however, have a physics mentality, and they say we're just going to throw ourselves at the problem, just beat our head against it until we get the answer. The astronomers think that this is totally nuts. So the physicists start out, and they work for a few years, and then the astronomers come along, and they say, okay, now it's time for the pros to do it, and they start to take over. So now you have these two teams going against each other, and they develop this very intense rivalry, which if you're interested in rivalries, it's a good one. And I actually, like, you know, this was in the mid-90s, and people have written about this before, but it's always been kind of glossed over. But enough time has passed now that they were actually speaking to me when I would interview them and talk about this period. They were actually speaking to me very frankly. It's like I would get up at the end of a conversation on the phone or something. This actually happened. This one astronomer said, I've never told anybody that, because he was really off ranting about somebody else. And then I talked to another astronomer. I said, Mario was really ranting about Bob. And that astronomer said, let me tell you about Bob. And then it just took off from there. So, these were people on the same team. I mean, the two teams were totally just, you know, at each other's throats, so to speak. So I'm going to read you a little bit now from the point in late 1997 when the two teams are converging. Oh, well, actually, there's a really telling anecdote. The team of physicists goes to the director of the Hubble Space Telescope Center in Baltimore, the Space Telescope Science Institute. He goes up to him in an astronomy meeting. He said, we're looking at supernovae, and we have this method for finding supernovae, and Hubble could do it a lot better. And the director says, well, I don't know much about supernovae, but put it in a proposal and we'll see. I mean, it sounds interesting. You know, maybe this is the kind of science that the space telescopes should be doing. So they put it into a proposal, and a couple of months later, the director goes to three guys on the other team and says, I don't know much about supernovae, but is this a good idea? And one guy on the team, one of the senior guys, says, no, it's a terrible idea. You shouldn't be using Hubble Space Telescope to be doing stuff that you can do from the ground. We're doing supernova searches from the ground. You don't need the space telescope for that. And the guy says, well, but, you know, I think it's interesting science, and, you know, it's director's discretionary time. I can assign it. You know, it's good science. Hubble should be doing good science. And they go, no. And the three of them are saying no. And one of them, actually, they all three confirmed this story, but as one of them put it, it's like, you could like feel like one at a time, each of them kind of like a light bulb went off, and they went, oh wait, he's telling us that if we want to use the space telescope, all we have to do is ask. So they asked for it, and then and the other team was obviously upset about this, and said, you know. So anyway, it turns out that the Hubble Space Telescope data turns out to be really important. It's like, it's decisive for both teams. So by late 1997, they're able to actually lay out the data and try to figure it out. And this scene is from the astronomers rather than the physicists. In the autumn of 1997, the two teams had enough data to try to find at least a preliminary answer to how much the rate of expansion of the universe was slowing down, and therefore whether the universe was heading toward a big chill or a big crunch. For the high Z team, that was the name of one of the teams, Adam Riess was now it. His task, that's what they called the person who was going to write the paper and do the research, you know, each step of the way. So you were it, and then you tagged the next guy, and he was it. His task was to take all the supernovae data to date and develop software that would compare it to millions of different models of the universe. Some of those models would be absurd, universes that, on a sheet of graph paper, would fall far from the straight 45-degree angle line I was talking about earlier, off in remote corners. Other models of the universe, however, would match slight deviations from that seemingly straight line. Within this subset, some models would match even slighter deviations, more subtle departures from the norm. And one of those universes would match his data. And one did. It was a universe that not only didn't have enough matter to slow the expansion, but had a mass density of -36%. It was a universe that didn't exist. Computers, he thought, don't know physics. They know only what we program them to know. Clearly, he had programmed his computer with impossible physics. So Riess checked his math, and he checked the computer code he'd written, and he couldn't find any mistakes. He had no choice but to try the alternative approach. Both teams had been operating under the assumption that the universe was full of matter and only matter. They therefore had also assumed that only matter would be influencing the expansion of the universe. What if he abandoned those assumptions? What if he considered a universe in which something else was affecting the expansion, a universe that consisted of something other than matter? He tried running that program. The result was a universe that consisted of maybe 20 or 30 or 40% matter, which left 60 or 70 or 80% something else. I'm only a postdoc, Riess told himself. I'm sure I've screwed up in 10 different ways. But he had already checked everything he knew to check, so Riess sent his results to team leader Brian Schmidt in Australia. Adam is sloppy, Schmidt reminded himself. Brilliant, but prone to mathematical errors. So Schmidt agreed to double-check the results. He would have to redo much of the math. As a rule, mathematicians don't check each other's work by reviewing the same calculations, but by performing the calculations independently so as not to be lulled into making the same mistakes. A routine soon developed. Reese would email Schmidt one step in the code, and a day later, Schmidt would respond. They signed their emails Pons and Fleischmann after the two physicists who, in 1989, had discovered cold fusion and who, after a long period of infamy, had fallen into obscurity. Sometimes when Reese couldn't wait for an answer, the phone would ring in the Schmidt household. Schmidt's wife, sleepless from caring for a six-month-old, would say, "If that's Adam, tell him to Schmidt." "Hello, Adam." "Reese." "Oh," a pause. "Is it early there?" "Schmidt, it's 4 a.m. "Reese." "Oh," a pause. "So, what do you know?" What Schmidt knew night after night was the same thing. So far, so good. Reese was getting married in January 1998, and when his future wife flew home from Berkeley, he started at Harvard and he went to Berkeley. When his wife flew home from Berkeley to her family in Connecticut a couple of weeks early to take care of the final preparations, Reese sequestered himself in his office in Campbell Hall on the Berkeley campus and began writing a paper that would report the results if they held up. The campus was empty for holiday break. The heating was off, and Reese had to bundle up. Even in California, December can get chilly. But every day, walking past the locked office doors and under the unlit hallway lights, he went to work. On December 22nd, he wrote an outline and started a draft. His team's previous paper, the first from the group, had been a short letter. Reese figured the next paper would have to be the War and Peace version, as scientists like to say. In the coming days, he also contacted a collaborator at the telescope in Chile and asked him to double-check some observations, though he didn't say why, so as not to prejudice the result. At one point, he beckoned another member of the team, also taking advantage of the semester break to catch up on work, into his office. Reese showed him what he'd been working on. "Man," the other astronomer said, "be sure the measurements are done right." By January 4th, Reese had taken the paper as far as he could, leaving blanks for what he didn't yet know. Then he flew east for his wedding, leaving Schmidt with the final round of analysis. On the evening of January 12th, Reese returned to Berkeley from the wedding before heading off the next morning on his honeymoon. He checked his email. The string of bold-faced, unread messages from the various members of the team, a dozen collaborators on 4 continents, stretched down the screen. Reese scrolled. Still, it stretched. When he got to the bottom of the list, he checked the timestamp to see how long the conversation had been going on without him. 48 hours, an eternity, he thought. He started at the bottom, a question from Schmidt. "How confident are we in this result?" "In your heart," a team member wrote back, "you know this is wrong, though your head tells you that you don't care and you're just reporting the observations." "I don't know about anyone else," another team member responded later that day, "but my heart tells me nothing about the result." They had a result, they had a confidence level, which led to the second question. Did they need to believe it in order to publish it? "It would be silly," an astronomer at Harvard wrote, "to report a result only to retract it next year. The other team has already done that," the physicists. They had a paper and then they took it back. "They're a year ahead of us, but I don't think we want to duplicate that path." Another astronomer, writing back from Germany that same day, agreed, "There is no point in writing an article if we are not very sure we are getting the right answer." One of the Chilean members of the collaboration concurred. "Press releases and a barrage of journal articles," he's referring to the other team's methods, "press releases and a barrage of journal articles may impress the public or scientists who have only a casual interest in the subject, but the hardcore cosmology community is not going to accept these results unless we can truly defend them." Brian Schmidt, however, disagreed. "As uncomfortable as I am with this result," he wrote, "I do not believe we should sit on it until we can find a reason for it being wrong. That, too, is not a correct way to do science." Correct way or not, there was a further concern, priority. "Of course, we want to remain true to our scientific ideals," wrote another member of the collaboration, "but this has to be balanced with real politics." "Who knows," another wrote, "this might be the right answer, and I would hate to see the other group publish it first." "And if it's the wrong answer?" Another team member argued that reporting a conclusion was a no-lose proposition. If you're right, you get priority. If you're wrong, you get a free pass. They had a reasonable argument, so why not make it? Why not? Reese saw no reason. He leaned into his keyboard and started to compose a response that he could send to the whole collaboration. When he looked up from the screen, he found his bride staring back at him. "I cannot believe," she said, "you are working on an email when we are on our way from our wedding to our honeymoon." "Well, this is a really important one." "Oh, I think I'm going to be hearing this all the time." "No, no," he said, "this, you're not. This really is. This is the one." She shook her head and left the room. Reese bent back to the keyboard, composing an email that would answer all the questions. "Heart or head? This data requires this result," he typed. "Approach it not with your heart or head, but with your eyes. We are observers, after all. Publicity? Priority? Real politic? You see, I feel like the tortoise racing the hare. Every day I see the other team here running around, but I think if I keep quiet, I can," because a lot of the other team was at Berkeley too, "if I keep quiet, I can sneak up on them. Shh." Finally, "Quick letter or war and peace? I think I can answer the group's dilemma about a quick kill paper versus a detailed explanation. You all said you wanted a detailed exposition of the data, so that's what I have been working on. Brian said that adding the data stuff to the paper should only take a week. Well, I did it already before the wedding." He hit send, and the next morning, he left for his honeymoon in Hawaii. Also, an observing run on the Keck telescope on Mauna Kea. So, in part, I mean, as bitter as this rivalry was, in part, it's because of this rivalry that the community took it seriously. When these two teams came up with the opposite result of what they expected, that the curve wasn't doing this, it was doing that, the supernovae were brighter than they should be, meaning that the universe the supernovae were dimmer than they should be, meaning that they were more distant than you would expect, meaning that the expansion was speeding up. Remember earlier I said, is it slowing down this much? Is it slowing down that much? It was doing this. It's speeding up. There's another component of the universe. They name it dark energy. And they take it seriously, as I said, partly because these two teams racing each other to beat each other both come up with the opposite result of what they expected. And so the community had to take it seriously. And they did. But as I said at the beginning, they also tried to knock it down. But the more they tried to knock it down, the more it rebounded. Now, I said earlier that there's 23%, 73%, 4%. Where do these numbers come from? In the mid-1960s, two astronomers working in New Jersey observed that there was this kind of buzz that they couldn't get rid of, which turned out to correspond to a prediction that people at Princeton were making, that the Big Bang should leave an echo in the universe, in effect, an echo. What happens is 380,000 years after, when the universe is 380,000 years old, the universe has cooled enough that matter and energy can go their separate ways. So if you look at that, and it's kind of frozen in time and it's everywhere around us, and in fact, in the old days, if you remember, when you used to turn the station on television and you'd get that kind of fuzzy stuff, that about 1% of that was this cosmic microwave background. You were looking at the Big Bang channel without realizing it. But now people understood what they were looking at. And they said, okay, but if there is this cosmic microwave background, because matter and energy went their separate ways, and because that matter and energy is still here today, and it's here in the form of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies and planets and stars and people, therefore it has to be there on that background. But at that time it was very uniform, and so they said, when we have sensitive enough instruments, we will be able to observe that. So it took them about 25 years to get the sensitive enough instrument off the ground, and it was called the Cosmic Background Explorer. And the results came out in 91, 92, which showed this map of the background, and indeed these fluctuations were in there. It still wasn't very distinct, it was still preliminary, but it really reinforced the idea of there being a Big Bang. Because here's a prediction. In science, you need to be able to make a prediction, and then you need to be able to make that observation to reinforce that prediction. If it hadn't been there, then all bets were off and there was no Big Bang. But it was there in the early 1990s. So they have this picture. But now they want a better picture of it. And about 10 years ago, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, or WMAP, went up into space to make the same kind of observation, but at a much higher level of precision, and it worked, and they found all these all the patterns in there that they wanted to find. Now, because this is a picture of the universe at that stage, you can run a computer simulation and say, what would the universe look like at that stage if there were, you know, 93% matter and 7% energy? The universe would look like this. Well, that doesn't match. So they run computer simulations of millions of universes to see which one, which particular percentage matches the observation that they're getting. And what they come up with is the 73-23-4% number. That when they run that computer simulation, that's what matches the data. So that's a very compelling argument. And it's not just WMAP, but it's again and again, they've been doing these observations in microwave telescopes from the ground as well. And they did a whole series from the South Pole. And in fact, I was down there a couple of years ago and I looked at where the instruments had been. And they're doing other experiments now too, down at the South Pole on this idea. So the data keeps coming in again and again and again and again. It gets better and better and better. And now it's very difficult to find somebody in astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology, who doesn't take this model very, very seriously. I mentioned the dark matter earlier, that the opening anecdote in the prologue. For dark matter, they have two candidates for what it might be. That's what they're trying to figure out. What is it? I don't need to go into why they have these candidates, but they're hypothetical particles. One is the neutralino, one is the axion. And there are experiments out there that are trying to detect these two. The anecdote at the beginning there was an attempt to detect the neutralino. And as I said, or as I hinted, these two detections that they got weren't compelling enough that you needed statistically. They weren't compelling enough statistically that you needed. If they had five, they could claim a detection. And as I said, they were expecting zero. And one would have been just, you know, noise in the data somewhere. But two was like close, but now somebody else gets to go out and make the same observation. And if they investigate the same bandwidth or whatever, you know, the same part of the graph, and they come up with five detections, then they get the Nobel, basically. For dark energy, the question isn't what it is, it's how it behaves. It's a real mystery. Before they can begin to say what it is, they need to figure out how is it affecting the expansion of the universe. So they need to look at the universe over various stages. And when I was down at the South Pole, actually, there was a telescope there that was making these observations farther into the universe and seeing, comparing the structure of galaxies. And I mean, if you've ever seen these pictures of large scale observations of the sky, you'll see that the universe is kind of structured like a spider web. There's lots of strands of galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies in these strands, and then a lot of space between them. And that's partly because dark matter has helped them clump in this way, according to all the computer simulations. That's what dark matter would do. But if you look at this in the sky, because the speed of light is finite, you're looking back in time because it takes time for the light to reach you. So the farther out you go, the farther back in time you are, and you can see the structures over a period of time. And so you can see how do those structures change, how much would that have changed the structure over time? So they're just trying to figure out how it behaves now. And there are all sorts of problems with it theoretically, because, you know, in particle physics, in quantum physics, space isn't empty. There's no such thing as empty space. It always has a quantum fluctuation quality to it. So there can't be something like, they're calling it vacuum energy, dark energy, but according to quantum theory, the value of vacuum energy should be 10 to the 60 or 10 to the 122 or 10 to infinity, depending on who you ask, bigger than it is, which is 0.73%. I'm sorry, 0.73 versus 10 to the 120. So there's this huge disparity there between observation and theory. And this is making them feel more than ever, something they've known for a long time, is that at some point we're going to have to reconcile general relativity and quantum theory. Einstein knew it, everybody knew it, and you could make, you could go for a long time without actually making that reconciliation. But the discovery of dark energy has pushed that eventual need into the foreground, so it becomes a very pressing need. And you know, you talk to these scientists, and they go, this is the most important problem out there. It's not only has huge implications for physics and philosophy, but it also is just this, you know, fundamental challenge to the physics of the universe. So I would like to read you now, and I'll wrap, this is in conclusion, I'll read you something near the end of the book that wraps up all of these ideas, I hope. And then I'll take questions. Since the invention of the telescope 4 centuries earlier, astronomers had been able to figure out the workings of the universe simply by observing the heavens and applying some math, and vice versa. Take the discovery of moons, planets, stars, and galaxies, apply Newton's laws, and you have a universe that runs like clockwork. Take Einstein's modifications of Newton, apply the discovery of cosmic expansion, and you get the Big Bang picture. What Saul Perlmutter, who is the leader of the physicist team of supernovae investigators in the 90s, what Saul Perlmutter once called a ridiculously simple, intentionally cartoonish picture. He was sitting in George Smoot's office on the Berkeley campus. 3 days earlier, Smoot had learned that he had won the 2006 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on COBE, that space mission that I was referring to in the early 90s that took the cosmic microwave background. Bearded, booming, eyes pinwheeling from adrenaline and lack of sleep, Smoot leaned back in his chair. Perlmutter leaned forward in his. Time and time again, Smoot shouted. He does. I was there for this. He does shout like this. In fact, I gave a talk last week at Berkeley Lab, and he was in the audience. He came up to me afterwards. And he said, "I don't sound like that." Well, time and time again, Smoot shouted. The universe has turned out to be really simple. Perlmutter nodded eagerly. It's like, why are we able to understand the universe at our level? Right, exactly. It's a universe for beginners. The universe for dummies. We're just incredibly lucky that first try has matched so well. Would our luck hold? If we took seriously the once-a-millennium quality of the dark universe revolution, and we had every reason to think we should, what physics needed was another Newton, someone, or someone's, or some collaboration, or some generations-long cathedral of a theory to codify the math of this new universe, to unite the physics of the very big with the physics of the very small, just as Newton had united the physics of the celestial with the physics of the terrestrial, to take the observations and make sense of our universe all over again in ways that we couldn't begin to imagine, but that would define our physics and philosophy, our civilization, for centuries to come. It was this prospect that led cosmologists to regard these originally disturbing discoveries of a universe beyond our senses with fascination and optimism, to view a seeming human limitation as a source of intellectual liberation. Or, as an astronomer told his colleagues at one conference on dark energy, if you put the timeline of the history of science before me and I could choose any time and field, this is where I'd want to be. So, let there be dark. Let there be doubt, even amid the certainty, especially amid the certainties, the pieces of evidence that in one generation transformed cosmology from metaphysics to physics, from speculation to science. In early 2010, the WMAP, the other satellite observatory of the cosmic microwave background, the WMAP 7-year results arrived bearing the latest refinements of the numbers that define our universe. It is 13.75 billion years old. It consists of 72.8% dark energy, 22.7% dark matter, and 4.56% the stuff of us. An exquisitely precise accounting of the depth of our ignorance. How the story would end remained a mystery for now and possibly forever. The astronomers who set out to write the final chapter in the history of the universe had to content themselves instead with a more modest conclusion. To be continued. Thanks. Thank you.
Our sun, obviously, are slower than the outer orbit, but when the next galaxy, Andromeda, you call it,
conflating two ideas. I'm talking about the solar system. Our solar system obeys it. But the galaxy is, our galaxy is full of many, 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 many suns, 100 billion suns. So in our solar system, it obeys that law, but the galaxy as a whole does not. I mean, according to what we see, just by, you know, naively.
Our solar system, okay, including all of our planets, okay?
Yeah.
Our solar system, yeah. But anything outside of our solar system then does not obey Newtonian physics.
No. No, the other things obey Newtonian physics, but our other things obey Newtonian physics, but it's based on, in our solar system, the mass of the sun and the masses of the planets and the distances and everything are enough to account for these motions. But outside obeys Newton as well. If you infer that there's something, that there's this dark matter there, it's not our solar system versus the rest of the universe. It's not our galaxy versus other galaxies. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yes. No, not yet. Not yet. Two questions there, if you couldn't hear. First question was how are parallel universes, the idea of parallel universes, how does that relate to dark matter and dark energy, if at all? And the second question was, what are the philosophical implications? I'll handle the second one first, because we don't know. I mean, that's the easy answer. But the argument that I'm trying to make in the book is that if this is indeed 1610 all over again, and I think it is, and the scientists pretty much think it is, you know, if you're Galileo in 1610, you don't go, oh, you know, this kind of discovery will lead to, you know, if I hold a telescope in my hand, somebody else can hold a telescope in their hand, and therefore it shifts the balance of power from the church, or the king to me, the individual, and all of us individuals, and that principle eventually leads to the Enlightenment and democracy. You know, I mean, you can't predict that. You know, there's no way of knowing. But it is that kind of fundamental restructuring. What I wanted in this book was, I'm hoping that people can see, or at least consider, that this is the moment when things are changing, and to be aware of that. And we don't know where it's going, but just to be aware of the change is in itself, a strong achievement. Something. And then the first question about parallel universes. I talk about this a little bit in the book. From my understanding, Brian Greene talks about this more. Remember earlier when I said that empty space isn't empty in quantum theory, that it's full of virtual particles popping into and out of existence and quantum fluctuations? Well, because there is no such thing as empty space, according to this theory that has been validated again and again and again and again over the past, 80 years or whatever, there is the possibility that the universe itself came out of one of these quantum pops, that it just kind of popped into existence because there is no such thing as nothing, and so this virtual particle comes into existence, undergoes a period of inflation, it's called, in the first fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second, where it expands faster than the speed of light, because space can do that. And if that's true, if there is inflation, and again, all the evidence is lining up that way, if there was this period of inflation, and if it did come out of this kind of quantum pop, then there's no way to turn off inflation, and there would, in fact, then be all these other universes out there. In which case, you could say, well, this is a totally absurd universe. We have 23% dark matter, we have 73% dark energy, and 4%, all the stuff we've ever thought was the universe. And it might be an absurd universe, except that if there are, hundreds and hundreds of quintillions of galaxies, of other universes out there, then they would have other physics, and their physics wouldn't be this one. We just happen to be in the one that has this 23-73-4 split. So this becomes obviously speculative, and it's called the anthropic principle. And astronomers used to hate it. Like when I first started looking at this, like 10 years ago or so. I mean, they just hated it. And I've seen them come around again and again because as the evidence from WMAP comes in and shows this is the way this universe looks, then the argument that the universe comes into being from this quantum pop becomes very compelling. And if that happens, then there is inflation. And if that happens, then there are all these other universes. And so now people are still leery of it because how do you make a prediction of something you can observe? You know, there's that question. But this is the direction that the thinking is heading in. So they do intersect in that way. Anybody else? He's asking how the universe would be defined now because the definition keeps changing. This is the current version, the one that I'm talking about, the one that I just summarized toward the end. That's what they're calling the concordance model now of dark matter, dark energy, baryons, the stuff of us, inflation, what I just referred to. So that's what they're calling the lambda refers to dark energy. So they call it the lambda cold dark matter plus inflation universe. That's the best they've got now. But will it change? Of course, yeah. I mean, it changes all the time. I mean, if they find dark matter, then they don't have to say cold dark matter. They say lambda axion plus inflation universe. You know, for instance. Yeah. But I well okay. I don't know what you mean by folding back on itself.
Well, if there is no such thing as empty space, and the universe is expanding into something that's not empty space, what is expanding
no, it's, into? Okay, that's a common question. The idea, and it's similar to asking what happened before the Big Bang. It's a matter of terminology that space and time are created in the universe. So the universe isn't expanding into anything. It's creating space as it expands. The space is expanding. It's not expanding into anything. I mean, it's a failure of language. I often have taken out Niels Bohr's philosophical writings from this library because he talks about the failings of our language, of human language, to express quantum ideas that we just. You know, we've had this classical training, and suddenly, the 20th century takes this turn, and our language hasn't developed a way to express it. Yes. Well, the question is, how did dark matter and dark energy reflect Einstein's? Like, is it resolving anything?
Yeah.
Well, it's Einstein was the one who inserted. I referred to lambda a few moments ago. He's the one who inserted lambda into the equations for general relativity to make a cosmological model. So he put lambda in there, which stabilized, because the universe, remember I said that that other galaxies were discovered in 1924 and the expansion was discovered in 1929, but he's writing these equations in 1917, and the equations tell him that the universe is volatile, that it's expanding or contracting. And, you know, you look out through the telescopes in those days and the universe isn't expanding or contracting. It's, you know, it's there. It's just there like it's always been. So he puts lambda in to balance it. And lambda is just a fudge factor. It just says there is a value here to counteract everything else so that the universe remains stable. 12 years later, the expansion of the universe is discovered. He takes lambda, he sets lambda to zero. I mean, people often say that he takes lambda out, but, you know, I explain this in the book. The book doesn't have equations or anything like that. I'm very careful not to do that kind of thing, but I do kind of walk you through it in the way that, well, when these astronomers, like Adam Riess, I was reading earlier, come up against this problem, then they have to educate themselves about the idea of lambda and the cosmological constant and all of that, which has always been there in the theories. And everybody has always said, assume that lambda equals zero, but now they have to assume that lambda equals something else, and it turns out that lambda equals 0.73. So in that way, it does it. So in that way, Einstein is very much present in these equations. But it was kind of cool that, you know. So what I tried to do, actually, this is just parenthetical. What I tried to do in this book is use these scientists who are educating themselves about the problems as they come up against them, and use that process as the conduit for the reader, so that we're kind of shoulder to shoulder with them while they're going, this doesn't make any sense. Okay, so lambda comes out that way, I think. Yes, you had your hand.
What? You use this 4%, 22%, 0.04 times what?
It's the percent of the mass energy density of the universe. The mass and energy in the universe. It's the universe. It's everything. It's you know, there's mass and there's energy, and it's both of those. Except only 4% of it exists, you know, the 4% that we thought, what we've always observed turns out to be only 4% of that mass and energy density. There's more mass, that's the dark matter. So, you know, we have 4% regular stuff, and then 23%, you know, dark matter, and then there's 73% dark matter.
4% of energy, mass, density.
Of the energy, it's 4% of the energy and mass in the universe.
And that is the energy, mass, density.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Should we? How many? I don't know how long to go, so I mean, I don't want people to get restless. But okay. Okay.
I read something that was kind of an op-ed about lung disease, and they spend a lot of time on the cosmological constant.
Right.
And the first report to Bill Einstein had been utterly fantastic and really shocked at him, and then it all went wrong, and Einstein said the worst speaker he said I've ever made. Then it came back to him, and as I remember, and my I'm fine when I'm reading, I'm fine when I'm listening, but when the reading and the listening stops, I'm so confused. Where is the cosmological constant in all of this beautiful?
Okay. It's another name for dark energy. Yeah, or lambda we were just talking about. Lambda would be the cosmological constant, but as I said, with dark energy, they're trying to figure out, does it remain the same over space and time, or does it change over space and time? If it stays the same over, if it's constant over space and time, then it's the cosmological constant. But it's not. But if it varies over space and time, then we don't know what it. I mean, we don't know what the cosmological constant is either. But we don't know what this thing that would change. But right now, all the evidence, all the measurements, including the ones that I was watching at the South Pole, are converging on it being constant over space and time, in which case it would be the cosmological constant. Okay? Thanks. Yes, in the back.
Is there any sense that the 4% or so is expanding as it
peaks? No. Right. Because it wouldn't be increasing or decreasing. I mean, that would imply the creation of that something is being transformed, that the dark energy is being transformed into baryons, or that the dark matter is being transformed into baryons. But that's I've never heard anything about that. Okay. Yes. Uh, No, because the ratio would remain the same, right? I mean, the space is expanding, but... No, it just means that the matter is there, and it's not going to change. I mean, it's just going to be there. It might take different forms. You know, if a supernova, you know, if a star blows up, then it creates new elements, but it's just creating it out of the same protons and neutrons. You know, the numbers of protons and neutrons aren't going to change. I don't know about fusion. Yeah, well, yeah, the dark matter is inferred by the motions of the galaxy that you need more matter there. And the dark energy is what they're punting, and they're calling that whatever it is that's expanding the universe. You know, we don't really know what it is.
In the observable universe, black holes change uniformly in time spectrum. I'm wondering if black energy.
Well, I guess the inert soup would be would be more the direction that they're thinking. Yeah. Which is actually a scientific term, inert soup. It's ongoing. It's from the beginning of the universe. The expansion has been going on, and the question is, the question that they were trying to resolve in the 90s was, what's going to happen with this expansion eventually? Will it stop and reverse itself, or will it just keep going? So it's ongoing now, and it's accelerating now. It hasn't always been accelerating because when the universe was smaller, even though the proportions of the things would have been the same, but because the matter would have been more compact, it was actually slowing down. And that's also a kind of a key moment in this book. The same scientist I was referring to, Adam Riess, later goes out and makes a measurement that shows that at a certain point, far in the past, you know, when I said that the line was curving up a little bit, at a certain point, even farther in the past, it has to curve down again because the universe is small enough that gravity should be winning the tug of war with dark energy. Now dark energy is winning, but at some point in the past, gravity should have been winning, and that's what they observe. So again, it's one of those things where it's like, you make a prediction, you go out and make the observation, you know, and it's there, you kind of go, okay. I mean, that was a very compelling moment, actually. When I talk about the community coming to take these questions seriously, I was there at a conference when he made that presentation of the dip going down, and it's, you know, I showed in the book, but it was quite a dramatic moment because the audience is filled with his peers. And even though he'd appeared at a press conference a couple of days earlier, they don't trust press conferences. They want to see the data for themselves. They want to see how tight the constraints are and margins of error and all the other stuff that are not going to be part of the press conference. And he walked the crowd through it, and it was like a jaw-dropping moment where people were just stunned. I mean, it was just like, you know, you just saw that in the crowd. It was amazing. Well, we don't know if other universes exist, so. Well, gravity would be, gravity is universal. Yeah, it's part of the universe, yeah. I mean, because you would look at, you know, how these distant galaxies are interacting and, you know. No, actually it's the weakest of the four forces. The way that they often illustrate this is, you know, if I had a paper clip here, put it there, and I took a magnet, magnetism is one of the forces, it would pick up the paper clip so that the entire gravitational tug of the entire Earth can be, you know, you can counteract it with a dime store magnet. So it's a very weak force, actually. Except, I mean, it's weak in terms of the other three forces, but the weak nuclear, the strong nuclear, and magnetism, right? Electromagnetism. Yeah. So. I'm not a scientist. I have to say that I'm a science. I mean, I write about science, but so relative to the other three, it's very weak. But obviously, it's strong enough that it can keep the universe intact. You know, so I think I'd probably just take one more before so that people don't get too tired, and then I guess I'll be signing books. Yes, sir. Well, exactly. That goes back to the question. Well, you can convert it, but, you know, good luck. You convert the dark energy. you find it. Seriously, though, it goes back to the question you were asking earlier about mass energy density of the universe, that because mass and energy are equal, according to Einstein, equals mc squared. So, you know, because they're two versions of the same thing, that's that whole is the universe, you know? See what I'm saying? Except they take different forms, energy and mass. But you could. I'm sorry? Well, we do. We do say that. I mean, you wouldn't. Yeah. I guess I'm not understanding. Yeah, it could be two versions of something, sure. I mean, you know, you can go. Well, I'm not, yeah, I don't know, I can't. I'm at a loss there. Anyway, thank you very much. And so, thanks.
I could
give it to you. Do you have a card? I could just.
We have a card, but yeah. My address. Let me write out my address.
Okay. Yeah. Good. I will sign, but I don't.